They talked of how they would live when they were married, how their husbands would be friends, and how happy they would be. On Natasha's table stood two looking-glasses, which Dunyasha had prepared beforehand. "Only when will all that be? I'm afraid never. It would be too good," said Natasha, rising and going to the looking-glasses. "Sit down, Natasha. Perhaps you'll see him," said Sonya. Natasha lit the candles, one on each side of the looking-glasses, and sat down. "I see someone with a moustache," said Natasha, seeing her own face. "You mustn't laugh, miss," said Dunyasha. With Sonya's help and the maid's, Natasha got the glass she held into the right position opposite the other. Her face assumed a serious expression, and she sat silent. She sat a long time, looking at the receding line of candles reflected in the glasses, and expecting, from tales she had heard, to see a coffin, or him, Prince Andrew, in that last, dim, indistinctly outlined square. But ready as she was to take the smallest speck for the image of a man or of a coffin, she saw nothing. She began blinking rapidly, and moved away from the looking-glasses. "Why is it others see things and I don't?" she said. "You sit down now, Sonya. You absolutely must tonight. Do it for me. Today I feel so frightened." Sonya sat down before the glasses, got the right position, and began looking. "Now Miss Sonya is sure to see something," whispered Dunyasha, "while you do nothing but laugh." Sonya heard this, and Natasha's whisper, "I know she will. She saw something last year." For about 3 minutes, all were silent. "Of course she will," whispered Natasha, but did not finish. Suddenly, Sonya pushed away the glass she was holding and covered her eyes with her hand. "Oh, Natasha," she cried. "Did you see? Did you? What was it?" exclaimed Natasha, holding up the looking-glass. Sonya had not seen anything. She was just wanting to blink and to get up when she heard Natasha say, "Of course she will." She did not wish to disappoint either Dunyasha or Natasha, but it was hard to sit still. She did not herself know how or why the exclamation escaped her when she covered her eyes. "You saw him?" urged Natasha, seizing her hand. "Yes, wait a bit. I saw him," Sonya could not help saying, not yet knowing whom Natasha meant by him, Nicholas or Prince Andrew. "But why shouldn't I say I saw something? Others do see. Besides, who can tell whether I saw anything or not?" flashed through Sonya's mind. "Yes, I saw him," she said. "How? Standing or lying?" "No, I saw... At first there was nothing. Then I saw him lying down." "Andrew lying? Is he ill?" asked Natasha, her frightened eyes fixed on her friend. "No, on the contrary. His face was cheerful, and he turned to me." And when saying this, she herself fancied she had really seen what she described. "Well, and then, Sonya?" "After that, I could not make out what there was. Something blue and red." "Sonya, when will he come back? When shall I see him? Oh, God, how afraid I am for him and for myself and about everything," Natasha began, and without replying to Sonya's words of comfort, she got into bed, and long after her candle was out, lay open-eyed and motionless, gazing at the moonlight through the frosty window panes. Chapter 13. His mother opposes Nicholas's wish to marry Sonya, and he returns to his regiment. Natasha becomes restless and impatient for Prince Andrew's return. Soon after the Christmas holidays, Nicholas told his mother of his love for Sonya and of his firm resolve to marry her. The Countess, who had long noticed what was going on between them and was expecting this declaration, listened to him in silence and then told her son that he might marry when he pleased, but that neither she nor his father would give their blessing to such a marriage. Nicholas, for the first time, felt that his mother was displeased with him, and that, despite her love for him, she would not give way. Coldly, without looking at her son, she sent for her husband, and when he came, tried briefly and coldly to inform him of the facts in her son's presence, but, unable to restrain herself, she burst into tears of vexation and left the room. The old count began irresolutely to admonish Nicholas and beg him to abandon his purpose. Nicholas replied that he could not go back on his word, and his father, sighing and evidently disconcerted, very soon became silent and went into the countess. In all his encounters with his son, The Count was always conscious of his own guilt toward him for having wasted the family fortune, and so he could not be angry with him for refusing to marry an heiress and choosing the dowerless Sonya. On this occasion, he was only more vividly conscious of the fact that if his affairs had not been in disorder, no better wife for Nicholas than Sonya could have been wished for, and that no one but himself, with his Mityanka and his uncomfortable habits, was to blame for the condition of the family finances. The father and mother did not speak of the matter to their son again. But a few days later, the Countess sent for Sonya, and with a cruelty neither of them expected, reproached her niece for trying to catch Nicholas and for ingratitude. Sonya listened silently with downcast eyes to the Countess's cruel words, without understanding what was required of her. She was ready to sacrifice everything for her benefactors. Self-sacrifice was her most cherished idea. But in this case, she could not see what she ought to sacrifice or for whom. She could not help loving the Countess and the whole Rostov family, but neither could she help loving Nicholas and knowing that his happiness depended on that love. She was silent and sad and did not reply. Nicholas felt the situation to be intolerable and went to have an explanation with his mother. He first implored her to forgive him and Sonya and consent to their marriage. Then he threatened that if she molested Sonya, he would at once marry her secretly. The Countess, with a coldness her son had never seen in her before, replied that he was of age, that Prince Andrew was marrying without his father's consent, and he could do the same, but that she would never receive that intriguer as her daughter. Exploding at the word intriguer, Nicholas, raising his voice, told his mother he had never expected her to try to force him to sell his feelings, but if that was so, he would say for the last time. But he had not time to utter the decisive word which the expression of his face caused his mother to await with terror, and which would perhaps have forever remained a cruel memory to them both. He had not time to say it, for Natasha, with a pale and set face, entered the room from the door at which she had been listening. "Nicholas, you're talking nonsense! Be quiet, be quiet, be quiet, I tell you!" she almost screamed so as to drown his voice. "Mamma, darling, it's not at all so. My poor, sweet darling," she said to her mother, who, conscious that they had been on the brink of a rupture, gazed at her son with terror, but in the obstinacy and excitement of the conflict, could not and would not give way. "Nicholas, I'll explain to you. Go away. Listen, Mamma, darling," said Natasha. Her words were incoherent, but they attained the purpose at which she was aiming. The Countess, sobbing heavily, hid her face on her daughter's breast, while Nicholas rose, clutching his head, and left the room. Natasha set to work to effect a reconciliation, and so far succeeded that Nicholas received a promise from his mother that Sonya should not be troubled, while he, on his side, promised not to undertake anything without his parents' knowledge. Firmly resolved, after putting his affairs in order in the regiment, to retire from the army and return and marry Sonya, Nicholas, serious, sorrowful, and at variance with his parents, but, as it seemed to him, passionately in love, left at the beginning of January to rejoin his regiment. After Nicholas had gone, things in the Rostov household were more depressing than ever, and the Countess fell ill from mental agitation. Sonya was unhappy at the separation from Nicholas, and still more so on account of the hostile tone the Countess could not help adopting toward her. The Count was more perturbed than ever by the condition of his affairs, which called for some decisive action. Their town house and estate near Moscow had inevitably to be sold, and for this they had to go to Moscow. But the Countess's health obliged them to delay their departure from day to day. Natasha, who had borne the first period of separation from her betrothed lightly and even cheerfully, now grew more agitated and impatient every day. The thought that her best days, which she would have employed in loving him, were being vainly wasted, with no advantage to anyone, tormented her incessantly. His letters, for the most part, irritated her. It hurt her to think that while she lived only in the thought of him, he was living a real life, seeing new places and new people that interested him. The more interesting his letters were, the more vexed she felt. Her letters to him, far from giving her any comfort, seemed to her a wearisome and artificial obligation. She could not write, because she could not conceive the possibility of expressing sincerely in a letter even a thousandth part of what she expressed by voice, smile, and glance. She wrote to him formal, monotonous, and dry letters, to which she attached no importance herself, and in the rough copies of which the Countess corrected her mistakes in spelling. There was still no improvement in the Countess's health, but it was impossible to defer the journey to Moscow any longer. Natasha's trousseau had to be ordered, and the house sold. Moreover, Prince Andrew was expected in Moscow, where old Prince Bolkonski was spending the winter, and Natasha felt sure he had already arrived. So the Countess remained in the country, and the Count, taking Sonya and Natasha with him, went to Moscow at the end of January. Book 8, 1811 to 1812. Chapter 1. Pierre's life in Moscow asks himself what for and why. After Prince Andrew's engagement to Natasha, Pierre, without any apparent cause, suddenly felt it impossible to go on living as before. Firmly convinced as he was of the truths revealed to him by his benefactor, and happy as he had been in perfecting his inner man, to which he had devoted himself with such ardor, all the zest of such a life vanished after the engagement of Andrew and Natasha and the death of Joseph Alexeyevich, the news of which reached him almost at the same time. Only the skeleton of life remained. His house, a brilliant wife who now enjoyed the favors of a very important personage, acquaintance with all Petersburg, and his court service with its dull formalities. And this life suddenly seemed to Pierre unexpectedly loathsome. He ceased keeping a diary, avoided the company of the brothers, began going to the club again, drank a great deal, and came once more in touch with the bachelor sets, leading such a life that the Countess Hélène thought it necessary to speak severely to him about it. Pierre felt that she was right, and to avoid compromising her, went away to Moscow. In Moscow, as soon as he entered his huge house in which the faded and fading princesses still lived, with its enormous retinue, as soon as, driving through the town, he saw the Iberian shrine, with innumerable tapers burning before the golden covers of the icons, the Kremlin square with its snow undisturbed by vehicles, the sleigh drivers and hovels of the Sitsiev Vrazhok, a slum district in Moscow, those old Muscovites who desired nothing, hurried nowhere, and were ending their days leisurely. When he saw those old Moscow ladies, the Moscow balls, and the English club, he felt himself at home in a quiet haven. In Moscow he felt at peace, at home, warm and dirty as in an old dressing gown. Moscow society, from the old women down to the children, received Pierre like a long-expected guest whose place was always ready awaiting him. For Moscow society, Pierre was the nicest, kindest, most intellectual, merriest, and most magnanimous of cranks, a heedless, genial nobleman of the old Russian type. His purse was always empty because it was open to everyone. Benefit performances, poor pictures, statues, benevolent societies, gypsy choirs, schools, subscription dinners, sprees, Freemasons, churches, and books. No one and nothing met with a refusal from him, and had it not been for two friends who had borrowed large sums from him and taken him under their protection, he would have given everything away. There was never a dinner or soiree at the club without him. As soon as he sank into his place on the sofa, after two bottles of Margaux, he was surrounded, and talking, disputing, and joking began. When there were quarrels, his kindly smile and well-timed jests reconciled the antagonists. The Masonic dinners were dull and dreary when he was not there. When after a bachelor supper he rose with his amiable and kindly smile, yielding to the entreaties of the festive company to drive off somewhere with them, shouts of delight and triumph arose among the young men. At balls he danced if a partner was needed. Young ladies, married and unmarried, liked him, because without making love to any of them, he was equally amiable to all, especially after supper. "Il est charmant, il n'a pas de sexe." "He's charming, he has no sex," they said of him. Pierre was one of those retired gentlemen-in-waiting, of whom there were hundreds good-humoredly ending their days in Moscow. How horrified he would have been 7 years before, when he first arrived from abroad, had he been told that there was no need for him to seek or plan anything, that his rut had long been shaped, eternally predetermined, and that, wriggle as he might, he would be what all in his position were. He could not have believed it. Had he not at one time longed with all his heart to establish a republic in Russia, then himself to be a Napoleon, then to be a philosopher, and then a strategist and the conqueror of Napoleon? Had he not seen the possibility of, and passionately desired, the regeneration of the sinful human race and his own progress to the highest degree of perfection? Had he not established schools and hospitals and liberated his serfs? But instead of all that, here he was, the wealthy husband of an unfaithful wife, a retired gentleman-in-waiting, fond of eating and drinking, and, as he unbuttoned his waistcoat, of abusing the government a bit, a member of the Moscow English Club, and a universal favorite in Moscow society. For a long time, he could not reconcile himself to the idea that he was one of those same retired Moscow gentlemen-in-waiting he had so despised 7 years before. Sometimes he consoled himself with the thought that he was only living this life temporarily, but then he was shocked by the thought of how many, like himself, had entered that life and that club temporarily with all their teeth and hair, and had only left it when not a single tooth or hair remained. In moments of pride, when he thought of his position, it seemed to him that he was quite different and distinct from those other retired gentlemen-in-waiting he had formerly despised. They were empty, stupid, contented fellows, satisfied with their position. Well, I'm still discontented and want to do something for mankind. But perhaps all these comrades of mine struggled just like me and sought something new, a path in life of their own, and like me were brought by force of circumstances, society, and race, by that elemental force against which man is powerless, to the condition I am in, said he to himself in moments of humility. And after living some time in Moscow, he no longer despised, but began to grow fond of, to respect, and to pity his comrades in destiny, as he pitied himself. Pierre no longer suffered moments of despair, hypochondria, and disgust with life, but the malady that had formerly found expression in such acute attacks was driven inwards and never left him for a moment. What for? Why? What is going on in the world? He would ask himself in perplexity several times a day, involuntarily beginning to reflect anew on the meaning of the phenomena of life. But knowing by experience that there were no answers to these questions, he made haste to turn away from them and took up a book or hurried off to the club or to Apollon Nikolaevich's to exchange the gossip of the town. Hélène, who has never cared for anything but her own body and is one of the stupidest women in the world, thought Pierre, is regarded by people as the acme of intelligence and refinement, and they pay homage to her. Napoleon Bonaparte was despised by all as long as he was great, but now that he has become a wretched comedian, the Emperor Francis wants to offer him his daughter in an illegal marriage. The Spaniards, through the Catholic clergy, offer praise to God for their victory over the French on the 14th of June, and the French, also through the Catholic clergy, offer praise because on that same 14th of June they defeated the Spaniards. My brother Masons swear by the blood that they are ready to sacrifice everything for their neighbor, but they do not give a ruble each to the collections for the poor. And they intrigue the Astrea Lodge against the manna seekers, and fuss about an authentic Scotch carpet and a charter that nobody needs and the meanings of which the very man who wrote it does not understand. We all profess the Christian law of forgiveness of injuries and love of our neighbors, the law in honor of which we built in Moscow 40 times 40 churches. But yesterday a deserter was knouted to death, and a minister of that same law of love and forgiveness, a priest, gave the soldier a cross to kiss before his execution. So thought Pierre, and the whole of this general deception which everyone accepts, accustomed as he was to it, astonished him each time as if it were something new. I understand the deception and confusion, he thought, but how am I to tell them all that I see? I've tried, and have always found that They, too, in the depths of their souls, understand it as I do, and only try not to see it. So it appears that it must be so. But I, what is to become of me? Thought he. He had the unfortunate capacity many men, especially Russians, have, of seeing and believing in the possibility of goodness and truth, but of seeing the evil and falsehood of life too clearly to be able to take a serious part in it. Every sphere of work was connected in his eyes with evil and deception. Whatever he tried to be, whatever he engaged in, the evil and falsehood of it repulsed him and blocked every path of activity. Yet he had to live and to find occupation. It was too dreadful to be under the burden of these insoluble problems, so he abandoned himself to any distraction in order to forget them. He frequented every kind of society, drank much, bought pictures, engaged in building, and above all, read. He read and read everything that came to hand. On coming home, while his valets were still taking off his things, he picked up a book and began to read. From reading, he passed to sleeping. From sleeping to gossip in drawing rooms of the club, from gossip to carousals and women, from carousals back to gossip, reading, and wine. Drinking became more and more a physical and also a moral necessity. Though the doctors warned him that with his corpulence wine was dangerous for him, he drank a great deal. He was only quite at ease when, having poured several glasses of wine mechanically into his large mouth, he felt a pleasant warmth in his body, an amiability toward all his fellows, and a readiness to respond superficially to every idea without probing it deeply. Only after emptying a bottle or two did he feel dimly that the terribly tangled skein of life which previously had terrified him was not as dreadful as he had thought. He was always conscious of some aspect of that skein, as with a buzzing in his head after dinner or supper he chatted or listened to conversation or read. But under the influence of wine, he said to himself, "It doesn't matter. I'll get it unraveled. I have a solution ready, but have no time now. I'll think it all out later on." But the later on never came. In the morning, on an empty stomach, all the old questions appeared as insoluble and terrible as ever, and Pierre hastily picked up a book, and if anyone came to see him, he was glad. Sometimes he remembered how he had heard that soldiers in war, when entrenched under the enemy's fire, if they have nothing to do, try hard to find some occupation the more easily to bear the danger. To Pierre, all men seemed like those soldiers, seeking refuge from life, some in ambition, some in cards, some in framing laws, some in women, some in toys, some in horses, some in politics, some in sport, some in wine, and some in governmental affairs. Nothing is trivial, and nothing is important. It's all the same. Only to save oneself from it as best one can, thought Pierre. Only not to see it. That dreadful it. Chapter 2. Prince N. Bolkonsky in Moscow. His harsh treatment of Princess Mary. She teaches little Nicholas, the old prince, and Mademoiselle Bourienne. At the beginning of winter, Prince Nicholas Bolkonsky and his daughter moved to Moscow. At that time, enthusiasm for the Emperor Alexander's regime had weakened, and a patriotic and anti-French tendency prevailed there. And this, together with his past and his intellect and his originality, at once made Prince Nicholas Bolkonsky an object of particular respect to the Muscovites, and the center of the Moscow opposition to the government. The prince had aged very much that year. He showed marked signs of senility by a tendency to fall asleep, forgetfulness of quite recent events, remembrance of remote ones, and the childish vanity with which he accepted the role of head of the Moscow opposition. In spite of this, the old man inspired in all his visitors alike a feeling of respectful veneration, especially of an evening when he came in to tea in his old-fashioned coat and powdered wig, and, aroused by anyone, told his abrupt stories of the past, or uttered yet more abrupt and scathing criticisms of the present. For them all, that old-fashioned house with its gigantic mirrors, pre-revolution furniture, powdered footmen, and the stern, shrewd old man, himself a relic of the past century, with his gentle daughter and the pretty French woman who were reverently devoted to him, presented a majestic and agreeable spectacle. But the visitors did not reflect that, besides the couple of hours during which they saw their host, there were also 22 hours in the day during which the private and intimate life of the house continued. Latterly, that private life had become very trying for Princess Mary. There in Moscow, she was deprived of her greatest pleasures, talks with the pilgrims, and the solitude which refreshed her at Bald Hills, and she had none of the advantages and pleasures of city life. She did not go out into society. Everyone knew that her father would not let her go anywhere without him, and his failing health prevented his going out himself, so that she was not invited to dinners and evening parties. She had quite abandoned the hope of getting married. She saw the coldness and malevolence with which the old prince received and dismissed the young men, possible suitors, who sometimes appeared at their house. She had no friends. During this visit to Moscow, she had been disappointed in the two who had been nearest to her. Mademoiselle Bourienne, with whom she had never been able to be quite frank, had now become unpleasant to her, and for various reasons Princess Mary avoided her. Julie, with whom she had corresponded for the last 5 years, was in Moscow, but proved to be quite alien to her when they met. Just then, Julie, who by the death of her brothers had become one of the richest heiresses in Moscow, was in the full whirl of society pleasures. She was surrounded by young men, who she fancied had suddenly learned to appreciate her worth. Julie was at that stage in the life of a society woman when she feels that her last chance of marrying has come, and that her fate must be decided now or never. On Thursdays, Princess Mary remembered with a mournful smile that she now had no one to write to, since Julie, whose presence gave her no pleasure, was here, and they met every week. Like the old émigré who declined to marry the lady with whom he had spent his evenings for years, she regretted Julie's presence and having no one to write to. In Moscow, Princess Mary had no one to talk to, no one to whom to confide her sorrow, and much sorrow fell to her lot just then. The time for Prince Andrew's return and marriage was approaching, but his request to her to prepare his father for it had not been carried out. In fact, it seemed as if matters were quite hopeless, for at every mention of the young Countess Rostova, the old prince, who apart from that was usually in a bad temper, lost control of himself. Another lately added sorrow arose from the lesson she gave her 6-year-old nephew. To her consternation, she detected in herself, in relation to little Nicholas, some symptoms of her father's irritability. However often she told herself that she must not get irritable when teaching her nephew, almost every time that, pointer in hand, she sat down to show him the French alphabet, she so longed to pour her own knowledge quickly and easily into the child, who was already afraid that Auntie might at any moment get angry, that at his slightest inattention she trembled, became flustered and heated, raised her voice, and sometimes pulled him by the arm and put him in the corner. Having put him in the corner, she would herself begin to cry over her cruel, evil nature, and little Nicholas, following her example, would sob, and without permission would leave his corner, come to her, pull her wet hands from her face, and comfort her. But what distressed the princess most of all was her father's irritability, which was always directed against her, and had of late amounted to cruelty. Had he forced her to prostrate herself to the ground all night, had he beaten her, or made her fetch wood or water, it would never have entered her mind to think her position hard. But this loving despot, the more cruel because he loved her, and for that reason tormented himself and her, knew how not merely to hurt and humiliate her deliberately, but to show her that she was always to blame for everything. Of late, he had exhibited a new trait that tormented Princess Mary more than anything else. This was his ever-increasing intimacy with Mademoiselle Bourienne. The idea that at the first moment of receiving the news of his son's intentions had occurred to him in jest, that if Andrew got married, he himself would marry Bourienne, had evidently pleased him. And latterly, he had persistently, and as it seemed to Princess Mary merely to offend her, shown special endearments to the companion and expressed his dissatisfaction with his daughter by demonstrations of love of Bourienne. One day in Moscow, in Princess Mary's presence, She thought her father did it purposely when she was there. The old prince kissed Mademoiselle Bourienne's hand, and drawing her to him, embraced her affectionately. Princess Mary flushed and ran out of the room. A few minutes later, Mademoiselle Bourienne came into Princess Mary's room, smiling and making cheerful remarks in her agreeable voice. Princess Mary hastily wiped away her tears, went resolutely up to Mademoiselle Bourienne, and, evidently unconscious of what she was doing, began shouting in angry haste at the Frenchwoman, her voice breaking. "It's horrible, vile, inhuman to take advantage of the weakness." She did not finish. "Leave my room," she exclaimed, and burst into sobs. Next day, the prince did not say a word to his daughter, but she noticed that at dinner he gave orders that Mademoiselle Bourienne should be served first. After dinner, when the footman handed coffee and from habit began with the princess, the prince suddenly grew furious, threw his stick at Philip, and instantly gave instructions to have him conscripted for the army. "He doesn't obey. I said it twice, and he doesn't obey. She is the first person in this house. She is my best friend," cried the prince. "And if you allow yourself," he screamed in a fury, addressing Princess Mary for the first time, "to forget yourself again before her, as you dared to do yesterday, I will show you who is master in this house. Go, don't let me set eyes on you. Beg her pardon." Princess Mary asked Mademoiselle Bourienne's pardon, and also her father's pardon, for herself and for Philip the footman, who had begged for her intervention. At such moments, something like a pride of sacrifice gathered in her soul. And suddenly, that father, whom she had judged, would look for his spectacles in her presence, fumbling near them and not seeing them, or would forget something that had just occurred, or take a false step with his failing legs and turn to see if anyone had noticed his feebleness, or, worst of all, at dinner, when there were no visitors to excite him, would suddenly fall asleep, letting his napkin drop and his shaking head sink over his plate. "He is old and feeble, and I dare to condemn him," she thought at such moments, with a feeling of revulsion against herself. Chapter 3. Dr. Métivier treated as a spy by the old prince. The dinner on the prince's name day. In 1811, there was living in Moscow a French doctor, Métivier, who had rapidly become the fashion. He was enormously tall, handsome, amiable, as Frenchmen are, and was, as all Moscow said, an extraordinarily clever doctor. He was received in the best houses not merely as a doctor, but as an equal. Prince Nicholas had always ridiculed medicine, but latterly, on Mademoiselle Bourienne's advice, had allowed this doctor to visit him and had grown accustomed to him. Métivier came to see the prince about twice a week. On December 6th, St. Nicholas's Day and the prince's name day, all Moscow came to the prince's front door. But he gave orders to admit no one, and to invite to dinner only a small number, a list of whom he gave to Princess Mary. Métivier, who came in the morning with his felicitations, considered it proper, in his quality of doctor, de forcer la consigne, to force the guard, as he told Princess Mary, and went in to see the prince. It happened that on that morning of his name day, the prince was in one of his worst moods. He had been going about the house all the morning, finding fault with everyone, and pretending not to understand what was said to him, and not to be understood himself. Princess Mary well knew this mood of quiet, absorbed querulousness, which generally culminated in a burst of rage, and she went about all that morning as though facing a cocked and loaded gun, and awaited the inevitable explosion. Until the doctor's arrival, the morning had passed off safely. After admitting the doctor, Princess Mary sat down with a book in the drawing-room, near the door through which she could hear all that passed in the study. At first she heard only Métivier's voice, then her father's, then both voices began speaking at the same time, the door was flung open, and on the threshold appeared the handsome figure of the terrified Métivier with his shock of black hair, and the prince in his dressing gown and fez, his face distorted with fury, and the pupils of his eyes rolled downwards. "You don't understand," shouted the prince, "but I do. French spy, slave of Buonaparte, spy, get out of my house. Be off, I tell you." And he slammed the door. Métivier, shrugging his shoulders, went up to Mademoiselle Bourienne, who at the sound of shouting had run in from an adjoining room. "The prince is not very well. Bile and rush of blood to the head. Keep calm. I will call again tomorrow," said Métivier, and putting his fingers to his lips, he hastened away. Through the study door came the sound of slippered feet and the cry, "Spies! Traitors! Traitors everywhere! Not a moment's peace in my own house!" After Métivier's departure, the old prince called his daughter in, and the whole weight of his wrath fell on her. She was to blame that a spy had been admitted. Had he not told her, yes, told her to make a list, and not to admit anyone who was not on that list? Then why was that scoundrel admitted? She was the cause of it all. With her, he said, he could not have a moment's peace and could not die quietly. "No, ma'am. We must part. We must part. Understand that. Understand it. I cannot endure any more," he said, and left the room. Then, as if afraid she might find some means of consolation, he returned, and trying to appear calm, added, "And don't imagine I have said this in a moment of anger. I am calm. I have thought it over, and it will be carried out. We must part. So find some place for yourself." But he could not restrain himself, and with the virulence of which only one who loves is capable, evidently suffering himself, he shook his fists at her and screamed, "If only some fool would marry her!" Then he slammed the door, sent for Mademoiselle Bourienne, and subsided into his study. At 2 o'clock, the 6 chosen guests assembled for dinner. These guests, the famous Count Rostopchin, Prince Lopukhin with his nephew, General Chatrov, an old war comrade of the prince's, and of the younger generation, Pierre and Boris Trubetskoy, awaited the prince in the drawing room. Boris, who had come to Moscow on leave a few days before, had been anxious to be presented to Prince Nicholas Bolkonski, and had contrived to ingratiate himself so well that the old prince in his case made an exception to the rule of not receiving bachelors in his house. The prince's house did not belong to what is known as fashionable society, but his little circle, though not much talked about in town, was one it was more flattering to be received in than any other. Boris had realized this the week before, when the commander-in-chief in his presence invited Rostopchin to dinner on St. Nicholas's Day, and Rostopchin had replied that he could not come. "On that day I always go to pay my devotions to the relics of Prince Nicholas Bolkonski." "Oh, yes, yes," replied the commander-in-chief. "How is he?" The small group that assembled before dinner in the lofty old-fashioned drawing-room with its old furniture resembled the solemn gathering of a court of justice. All were silent or talked in low tones. Prince Nicholas came in, serious and taciturn. Princess Mary seemed even quieter and more diffident than usual. The guests were reluctant to address her, feeling that she was in no mood for their conversation. Count Rostopchin alone kept the conversation going, now relating the latest town news and now the latest political gossip. Lopukhin and the old general occasionally took part in the conversation. Prince Bolkonski listened as a presiding judge receives a report, only now and then, silently or by a brief word, showing that he took heed of what was being reported to him. The tone of the conversation was such as indicated that no one approved of what was being done in the political world. Incidents were related, evidently confirming the opinion that everything was going from bad to worse. But whether telling a story or giving an opinion, the speaker always stopped, or was stopped, at the point beyond which his criticism might touch the sovereign himself. At dinner, the talk turned on the latest political news, Napoleon's seizure of the Duke of Oldenburg's territory, and the Russian note hostile to Napoleon, which had been sent to all the European courts. "Bonaparte treats Europe as a pirate does a captured vessel," said Count Rostopchin, repeating a phrase he had uttered several times before. "One only wonders at the long-suffering or blindness of the crowned heads. Now the Pope's turn has come, and Bonaparte doesn't scruple to depose the head of the Catholic Church. Yet all keep silent. Our sovereign alone has protested against the seizure of the Duke of Oldenburg's territory, and even..." Count Rostopchin paused, feeling that he had reached the limit beyond which censure was impossible. "Other territories have been offered in exchange for the Duchy of Oldenburg," said Prince Bolkonski. "He shifts the dukes about as I might move my serfs from Bald Hills to Boguchárovo or my Ryazan estates." "The Duke of Oldenburg bears his misfortunes with admirable strength of character and resignation," remarked Boris, joining in respectfully. He said this because on his journey from Petersburg he had had the honor of being presented to the duke. Prince Bolkonski glanced at the young man as if about to say something in reply, but changed his mind, evidently considering him too young. I have read our protests about the Oldenburg affair, and was surprised how badly the note was worded, remarked Count Rostopchin in the casual tone of a man dealing with a subject quite familiar to him. Pierre looked at Rostopchin with naive astonishment, not understanding why he should be disturbed by the bad composition of the note. "Does it matter, Count, how the note is worded?" he asked, "so long as its substance is forcible?" "My dear fellow, with our 500,000 troops it should be easy to have a good style," returned Count Rostopchin. Pierre now understood the Count's dissatisfaction with the wording of the note. "One would have thought quill-drivers enough had sprung up," remarked the old prince. "There in Petersburg they're always writing. Not notes only, but even new laws. My Andrew there has written a whole volume of laws for Russia. Nowadays they're always writing." And he laughed unnaturally. There was a momentary pause in the conversation. The old general cleared his throat to draw attention. "Did you hear of the last event at the review in Petersburg? The figure cut by the new French ambassador?" "Eh? Yes, I heard something. He said something awkward in His Majesty's presence." "His Majesty drew attention to the Grenadier Division and to the march past," continued the general, "and it seems the ambassador took no notice and allowed himself to reply that we in France pay no attention to such trifles." The emperor did not condescend to reply. At the next review, they say, the emperor did not once deign to address him. All was silent. On this fact relating to the emperor personally, it was impossible to pass any judgment. "Impudent fellows," said the prince. "You know Métivier. I turned him out of my house this morning. He was here. They admitted him in spite of my request that they should let no one in." He went on, glancing angrily at his daughter. And he narrated his whole conversation with the French doctor and the reasons that convinced him that Métivier was a spy. Though these reasons were very insufficient and obscure, no one made any rejoinder. After the roast, champagne was served. The guests rose to congratulate the old prince. Princess Mary, too, went round to him. He gave her a cold, angry look, and offered her his wrinkled, clean-shaven cheek to kiss. The whole expression of his face told her that he had not forgotten the morning's talk, that his decision remained in force, and only the presence of visitors hindered his speaking of it to her now. When they went into the drawing-room where coffee was served, the old men sat together. Prince Nicholas grew more animated and expressed his views on the impending war. He said that our wars with Bonaparte would be disastrous so long as we sought alliances with the Germans and thrust ourselves into European affairs, into which we had been drawn by the Peace of Tilsit. "We ought not to fight either for or against Austria. Our political interests are all in the East, and in regard to Bonaparte, the only thing is to have an armed frontier and a firm policy. And he will never dare to cross the Russian frontier, as was the case in 1807. "How can we fight the French prince?" said Count Rostopchin. "Can we arm ourselves against our teachers and divinities? Look at our youths. Look at our ladies. The French are our gods. Paris is our kingdom of heaven." He began speaking louder, evidently to be heard by everyone. "French dresses, French ideas, French feelings. There now. You turned Métivier out by the scruff of his neck because he is a Frenchman and a scoundrel, but our ladies crawl after him on their knees. I went to a party last night, and there, out of five ladies, three were Roman Catholics and had the Pope's indulgence for doing wool work on Sundays. And they themselves sit there nearly naked, like the signboards at our public baths, if I may say so. When one looks at our young people, Prince, one would like to take Peter the Great's old cudgel out of the museum and belabor them in the Russian way till all the nonsense jumps out of them." All were silent. The old prince looked at Rostopchin with a smile and wagged his head approvingly. "Well, goodbye, Your Excellency. Keep well," said Rostopchin, getting up with characteristic briskness and holding out his hand to the prince. "Goodbye, my dear fellow. His words are music. I never tire of hearing him," said the old prince, keeping hold of the hand and offering his cheek to be kissed. Following Rostopchin's example, the others also rose. Chapter 4. Pierre and Princess Mary discuss Boris and Natasha. Princess Mary, as she sat listening to the old man's talk and fault-finding, understood nothing of what she heard. She only wondered whether the guests had all observed her father's hostile attitude toward her. She did not even notice the special attentions and amiability shown her during dinner by Boris Trubetskoy, who was visiting them for the third time already. Princess Mary turned with an absent-minded, questioning look to Pierre, who, hat in hand and with a smile on his face, was the last of the guests to approach her after the old prince had gone out and they were left alone in the drawing-room. "May I stay a little longer?" he said, letting his stout body sink into an armchair beside her. "Oh, yes," she answered. "You noticed nothing?" her look asked. Pierre was in an agreeable after-dinner mood. He looked straight before him and smiled quietly. "Have you known that young man long, princess?" he asked. "Who?" "Trubetskoy." "No, not long. Do you like him?" "Yes, he's an agreeable young man." "Why do you ask me that?" said Princess Mary, still thinking of that morning's conversation with her father. "Because I've noticed that when a young man comes on leave from Petersburg to Moscow, it is usually with the object of marrying an heiress." "You've observed that?" said Princess Mary. "Yes," returned Pierre with a smile. "And this young man now manages matters so that where there is a wealthy heiress, there he is too. I can read him like a book. At present, he is hesitating whom to lay siege to, you or Mademoiselle Julie Karagina. He's very attentive to her."
"He visits them?"
"Yes, very often." "And do you know the new way of courting?" said Pierre with an amused smile, evidently in that cheerful mood of good-humoured raillery for which he so often reproached himself in his diary.
"No," replied Princess Mary.
"Well, to please Moscow girls nowadays, one has to be melancholy." "He's very melancholy with Mademoiselle Karagina," said Pierre.
"Really?"
asked Princess Mary, looking into Pierre's kindly face and still thinking of her own sorrow.
"It would be a relief," thought she, "if I ventured to confide what I'm feeling to someone. I should like to tell everything to Pierre. He's kind and generous. It would be a relief. He would give me advice."
"Would you marry him?"
Oh, my God, Count, there are moments when I would marry anybody," she cried suddenly to her own surprise, and with tears in her voice. "Oh, how bitter it is to love someone near to you, and to feel that," she went on in a trembling voice, "that you can do nothing for him but grieve him, and to know that you cannot alter this. Then there is only one thing left, to go away. But where could I go?"
"What is wrong? What is it, princess?" But without finishing what she was saying, Princess Mary burst into tears.
"I don't know what's the matter with me today. Don't take any notice. Forget what I've said."
Pierre's gaiety vanished completely. He anxiously questioned the princess, asked her to speak out fully and confide her grief to him. But she only repeated that she begged him to forget what she had said, that she did not remember what she had said, and that she had no trouble except the one he knew of, that Prince Andrew's marriage threatened to cause a rupture between father and son.
"Have you any news of the Rostovs?" she asked, to change the subject. "I was told they're coming soon. I'm also expecting Andrew any day. I should like them to meet here."
"And how does he now regard the matter?" asked Pierre, referring to the old prince. Princess Mary shook her head.
"What is to be done? In a few months the year will be up. The thing is impossible. I only wish I could spare my brother the first moments. I wish they would come sooner. I hope to be friends with her."
"You've known them a long time," said Princess Mary. "Tell me honestly the whole truth. What sort of girl is she, and what do you think of her?
The real truth, because you know Andrew is risking so much doing this against his father's will that I should like to know."
An undefined instinct told Pierre that these explanations and repeated requests to be told the whole truth expressed ill will on the princess's part toward her future sister-in-law and a wish that he should disapprove of Andrew's choice. But in reply, he said what he felt rather than what he thought.
"I don't know how to answer your question," he said, blushing without knowing why. "I really don't know what sort of girl she is. I can't analyze her at all. She's enchanting, but what makes her so, I don't know. That is all one can say about her."
Princess Mary sighed, and the expression on her face said,
Yes, that's what I expected and feared. Is she clever? She asked. Pierre considered. I think not, he said. And yet, yes, she does not deign to be clever. Oh, no, she's simply enchanting, and that is all. Princess Mary again shook her head disapprovingly. Oh, I so long to like her. Tell her so if you see her before I do. I hear they're expected very soon, said Pierre. Princess Mary told Pierre of her plan to become intimate with her future sister-in-law as soon as the Rostovs arrived, and to try to accustom the old prince to her. Chapter 5. Boris and Julie. Their melancholy. Boris proposes and is accepted. Boris had not succeeded in making a wealthy match in Petersburg, so with the same object in view he came to Moscow. There he wavered between the two richest heiresses, Julie and Princess Mary. Though Princess Mary, despite her plainness, seemed to him more attractive than Julie, he, without knowing why, felt awkward about paying court to her. When they had last met on the old prince's name day, she had answered at random all his attempts to talk sentimentally, evidently not listening to what he was saying. Julie, on the contrary, accepted his attentions readily, though in a manner peculiar to herself. She was 27. After the death of her brothers, she had become very wealthy. She was by now decidedly plain, but thought herself not merely as good-looking as before, but even far more attractive. She was confirmed in this delusion by the fact that she had become a very wealthy heiress, and also by the fact that the older she grew, the less dangerous she became to men, and the more freely they could associate with her and avail themselves of her suppers, soirees, and the animated company that assembled at her house, without incurring any obligation. A man who would have been afraid 10 years before of going every day to the house when there was a girl of 17 there, for fear of compromising her and committing himself, would now go boldly every day and treat her not as a marriageable girl, but as a sexless acquaintance. That winter, the Karagins' house was the most agreeable and hospitable in Moscow. In addition to the formal evening and dinner parties, a large company, chiefly of men, gathered there every day, supping at midnight and staying till 3 in the morning. Julie never missed a ball, a promenade, or a play. Her dresses were always of the latest fashion. But in spite of that, she seemed to be disillusioned about everything, and told everyone that she did not believe either in friendship or in love, or any of the joys of life, and expected peace only yonder. She adopted the tone of one who has suffered a great disappointment, like a girl who has either lost the man she loved or been cruelly deceived by him. Though nothing of the kind had happened to her, she was regarded in that light, and had even herself come to believe that she had suffered much in life. This melancholy, which did not prevent her amusing herself, did not hinder the young people who came to her house from passing the time pleasantly. Every visitor who came to the house paid his tribute to the melancholy mood of the hostess, and then amused himself with society gossip, dancing, intellectual games, and bourrime, rhyming games, which were in vogue at the Karagins'. Only a few of these young men, among them Boris, entered more deeply into Julie's melancholy, and with these she had prolonged conversations in private on the vanity of all worldly things. And to them she showed her albums filled with mournful sketches, maxims, and verses. To Boris, Julie was particularly gracious. She regretted his early disillusionment with life, offered him such consolation of friendship as she who had herself suffered so much could render, and showed him her album. Boris sketched 2 trees in the album and wrote, "Rustic trees, your dark branches shed gloom and melancholy upon me." On another page he drew a tomb and wrote, "L'amour est secourable et l'amour est tranquille. Ah, contre les douleurs, il n'y a pas d'autre asile. Death gives relief and death is peaceful. Ah, from suffering there is no other refuge." Julie said this was charming. "There is something so enchanting in the smile of melancholy," she said to Boris, repeating word for word a passage she had copied from a book. "It is a ray of light in the darkness, a shade between sadness and despair, showing the possibility of consolation." In reply, Boris wrote these lines, "Aliment de poison d'une âme trop sensible, toi sans qui le bonheur me serait impossible, tendre mélancolie, viens me consoler,
Viens calmer les tourments de ma sombre retraite et mêle une douceur secrète à ces pleurs que je sens couler. Poisonous nourishment of a too sensitive soul, thou, without whom happiness would for me be impossible, tender melancholy, ah, come to console me. Come to calm the torments of my gloomy retreat and mingle a secret sweetness with these tears that I feel to be flowing. For Boris, Julie played most doleful nocturnes on her harp. Boris read Poor Lisa aloud to her, and more than once interrupted the reading because of the emotions that choked him. Meeting at large gatherings, Julie and Boris looked on one another as the only souls who understood one another in a world of indifferent people. Anna Mikhailovna, who often visited the Karagins, while playing cards with the mother, made careful inquiries as to Julie's dowry. She was to have two estates in Pienza and the Nizhegorod forests. Anna Mikhailovna regarded the refined sadness that united her son to the wealthy Julie with emotion and resignation to the divine will. "You are always charming and melancholy, my dear Julie," she said to the daughter. "Boris says his soul finds repose at your house. He has suffered so many disappointments and is so sensitive," said she to the mother. "Ah, my dear, I can't tell you how fond I've grown of Julie latterly," she said to her son. "But who could help loving her? She is an angelic being." "Ah, Boris, Boris," she paused. "And how I pity her mother," she went on. "Today she showed me her accounts and letters from Pienza. They have enormous estates there. And she, poor thing, has no one to help her, and they do cheat her so." Boris smiled almost imperceptibly while listening to his mother. He laughed blandly at her naive diplomacy, but listened to what she had to say, and sometimes questioned her carefully about the Pienza and Nizhegorod estates. Julie had long been expecting a proposal from her melancholy adorer, and was ready to accept it. But some secret feeling of repulsion for her passionate desire to get married, for her artificiality, and a feeling of horror at renouncing the possibility of real love, still restrained Boris. His leave was expiring. He spent every day and whole days at the Karagins, and every day, on thinking the matter over, told himself that he would propose tomorrow. But in Julie's presence, looking at her red face and chin, nearly always powdered, her moist eyes, and her expression of continual readiness to pass at once from melancholy to an unnatural rapture of married bliss, Boris could not utter the decisive words, though in imagination he had long regarded himself as the possessor of those Pienza and Nizhegorod estates, and had apportioned the use of the income from them. Julie saw Boris's indecision, and sometimes the thought occurred to her that she was repulsive to him. But her feminine self-deception immediately supplied her with consolation, and she told herself that he was only shy from love. Her melancholy, however, began to turn to irritability, and not long before Boris's departure, she formed a definite plan of action. Just as Boris's leave of absence was expiring, Anatole Kuragin made his appearance in Moscow, and of course in the Karagins' drawing room. And Julie, suddenly abandoning her melancholy, became cheerful and very attentive to Kuragin. "My dear," said Anna Mikhailovna to her son, "I know from a reliable source that Prince Vasily has sent his son to Moscow to get him married to Julie. I'm so fond of Julie that I should be sorry for her. What do you think of it, my dear?" The idea of being made a fool of, and of having thrown away that whole month of arduous melancholy service to Julie, and of seeing all the revenue from the Pienza estates which he had already mentally apportioned and put to proper use fall into the hands of another, and especially into the hands of that idiot Anatole, pained Boris. He drove to the Karagins with the firm intention of proposing. Julie met him in a gay, careless manner, spoke casually of how she had enjoyed yesterday's ball, and asked when he was leaving. Though Boris had come intentionally to speak of his love, and therefore meant to be tender, he began speaking irritably of feminine inconstancy, of how easily women can turn from sadness to joy, and how their moods depend solely on who happens to be paying court to them. Julie was offended, and replied that it was true that a woman needs variety, and the same thing over and over again would weary anyone. "Then I should advise you," Boris began, wishing to sting her,
But at that instant, the galling thought occurred to him that he might have to leave Moscow without having accomplished his aim and have vainly wasted his efforts, which was a thing he never allowed to happen. He checked himself in the middle of the sentence, lowered his eyes to avoid seeing her unpleasantly irritated and irresolute face, and said, "I did not come here at all to quarrel with you. On the contrary," he glanced at her to make sure that he might go on. Her irritability had suddenly quite vanished, and her anxious, imploring eyes were fixed on him with greedy expectation. "I can always arrange so as not to see her often," thought Boris. "The affair has been begun and must be finished." He blushed hotly, raised his eyes to hers, and said, "You know my feelings for you." There was no need to say more. Julie's face shone with triumph and self-satisfaction. But she forced Boris to say all that is said on such occasions, that he loved her and had never loved any other woman more than her. She knew that for the Penza estates and Nizhegorod forests she could demand this, and she received what she demanded. The affianced couple, no longer alluding to trees that shed gloom and melancholy upon them, planned the arrangements of a splendid house in Petersburg, paid calls, and prepared everything for a brilliant wedding. Chapter 6. Count Ilya Rostov, Natasha, and Sonya stay with Marya Dmitrievna in Moscow. At the end of January, old Count Rostov went to Moscow with Natasha and Sonya. The Countess was still unwell and unable to travel, but it was impossible to wait for her recovery. Prince Andrew was expected in Moscow any day, the trousseau had to be ordered, and the estate near Moscow had to be sold, besides which the opportunity of presenting his future daughter-in-law to old Prince Bolkonski while he was in Moscow could not be missed. The Rostovs' Moscow house had not been heated that winter, and as they had come only for a short time, and the Countess was not with them, the Count decided to stay with Marya Dmitrievna Akhrosimova, who had long been pressing her hospitality on them. Late one evening, the Rostovs' four sleighs drove into Marya Dmitrievna's courtyard in the old Konyushny Street. Marya Dmitrievna lived alone. She had already married off her daughter, and her sons were all in the service. She held herself as erect, told everyone her opinion as candidly, loudly, and bluntly as ever, and her whole being seemed a reproach to others for any weakness, passion, or temptation, the possibility of which she did not admit. From early in the morning, wearing a dressing jacket, she attended to her household affairs, and then she drove out, on holy days to church, and after the service to jails and prisons, on affairs of which she never spoke to anyone. Note, in Russia the fate of prisoners was a hard one. They suffered much want, and to contribute to their needs was a recognized Christian duty. On ordinary days, after dressing, she received petitioners of various classes, of whom there were always some. Then she had dinner, a substantial and appetizing meal, at which there were always three or four guests. After dinner she played a game of Boston, and at night she had the newspapers or a new book read to her while she knitted. She rarely made an exception and went out to pay visits, and then only to the most important persons in the town. She had not yet gone to bed when the Rostovs arrived, and the pulley of the hall door squeaked from the cold as it let in the Rostovs and their servants. Marya Dmitrievna, with her spectacles hanging down on her nose and her head flung back, stood in the hall doorway looking with a stern, grim face at the new arrivals. One might have thought she was angry with the travellers and would immediately turn them out, had she not at the same time been giving careful instructions to the servants for the accommodation of the visitors and their belongings. "The Count's things? Bring them here," she said, pointing to the portmanteaus and not greeting anyone. "The young ladies, there to the left. Now, what are you dawdling for?" she cried to the maids. "Get the samovar ready." "You've grown plumper and prettier," she remarked, drawing Natasha, whose cheeks were glowing from the cold, to her by the hood. "Oof, oof, you are cold. Now, take off your things quick," she shouted to the Count, who was going to kiss her hand. "You're half frozen, I'm sure. Bring some rum for tea." "Bonjour, Sonya, dear," she added, turning to Sonya, and indicating by this French greeting her slightly contemptuous, though affectionate, attitude toward her. When they came into tea, having taken off their outdoor things and tidied themselves up after their journey, Marya Dmitrievna kissed them all in due order. "I'm heartily glad you've come and are staying with me." "It was high time," she said, giving Natasha a significant look. "The old man is here, and his son's expected any day. You'll have to make his acquaintance. But we'll speak of that later on, she added, glancing at Sonya with a look that showed she did not want to speak of it in her presence. Now, listen, she said to the Count. What do you want tomorrow? Whom will you send for? Shinshin? She crooked one of her fingers. The snivelling Anna Mikhailovna? That's two. She's here with her son. The son is getting married. Then, Bezukhov, eh? He's here, too, with his wife. He ran away from her, and she came galloping after him. He dined with me on Wednesday. As for them, and she pointed to the girls, tomorrow I'll take them first to the Iberian Shrine of the Mother of God, and then we'll drive to the Super Rogues. Note, a pun on Super Rogue, the dressmaker's name. I suppose you'll have everything new. Don't judge by me. Sleeves nowadays are this size. The other day, young Princess Irina Vasilievna came to see me. She was an awful sight, looked as if she'd put two barrels on her arms. You know, not a day passes now without some new fashion. And what have you to do yourself? She asked the Count sternly. One thing has come on top of another. Her rags to buy, and now a purchaser has turned up for the Moscow estate and for the house. If you will be so kind, I'll fix a time and go down to the estate just for a day and leave my lassies with you. All right, they'll be safe with me, as safe as in Chancery. I'll take them where they must go, scold them a bit, and pet them a bit, said Marya Dmitrievna, touching her goddaughter and favorite Natasha on the cheek with her large hand. Next morning, Marya Dmitrievna took the young ladies to the Iberian Shrine of the Mother of God, and to Madame Super Rogue, who was so afraid of Marya Dmitrievna that she always let her have costumes at a loss merely to get rid of her. Marya Dmitrievna ordered almost the whole trousseau. When they got home, she turned everybody out of the room except Natasha, and then called her pet to her armchair. Well, now we'll talk. I congratulate you on your betrothed. You've hooked a fine fellow. I'm glad for your sake, and I've known him since he was so high. She held her hand a couple of feet from the ground. Natasha blushed happily. I like him and all his family. Now listen. You know that old Prince Nicholas much dislikes his son's marrying. The old fellow's crotchety. Of course, Prince Andrew's not a child and can shift without him, but it's not nice to enter a family against a father's will. One wants to do it peacefully and lovingly. You're a clever girl, and you'll know how to manage. Be kind and use your wits. Then all will be well. Natasha remained silent. From shyness, Marya Dmitrievna supposed, but really because she disliked anyone interfering in what touched her love of Prince Andrew, which seemed to her so apart from all human affairs that no one could understand it. She loved and knew Prince Andrew. He loved her only, and was to come one of these days and take her. She wanted nothing more. You see, I've known him a long time, and am also fond of Mary, your future sister-in-law. Husband's sisters bring up blisters, but this one wouldn't hurt a fly. She's asked me to bring you two together. Tomorrow you'll go with your father to see her. Be very nice and affectionate to her. You're younger than she. When he comes, he'll find you already know his sister and father and are liked by them. Am I right or not? Won't that be best? Yes, it will, Natasha answered reluctantly. Chapter 7 Count Rostov and Natasha call on Prince N. Bolkonski. They are received by Princess Mary. Prince Bolkonski's strange behavior. Mary and Natasha dislike one another. Next day, by Marya Dmitrievna's advice, Count Rostov took Natasha to call on Prince Nicholas Bolkonski. The Count did not set out cheerfully on this visit. At heart, he felt afraid. He well remembered the last interview he had had with the old prince at the time of the enrollment, when, in reply to an invitation to dinner, he had had to listen to an angry reprimand for not having provided his full quota of men. Natasha, on the other hand, having put on her best gown, was in the highest spirits. They can't help liking me, she thought. Everybody always has liked me, and I'm so willing to do anything they wish, so ready to be fond of him for being his father, and of her for being his sister, that there's no reason for them not to like me. They drove up to the gloomy old house on the Vozdvizhenka, and entered the vestibule. "Well, the Lord have mercy on us," said the Count, half in jest, half in earnest. But Natasha noticed that her father was flurried on entering the anteroom, and inquired timidly and softly whether the prince and princess were at home. When they had been announced, a perturbation was noticeable among the servants. The footman who had gone to announce them was stopped by another in the large hall, and they whispered to one another. Then a maidservant ran into the hall and hurriedly said something, mentioning the princess. At last, an old cross-looking footman came and announced to the Rostovs that the prince was not receiving, but that the princess begged them to walk up. The first person who came to meet the visitors was Mademoiselle Bourienne. She greeted the father and daughter with special politeness and showed them to the princess's room. The princess, looking excited and nervous, her face flushed in patches, ran in to meet the visitors, treading heavily and vainly trying to appear cordial and at ease. From the first glance, Princess Mary did not like Natasha. She thought her too fashionably dressed, frivolously gay, and vain. She did not at all realize that before having seen her future sister-in-law, she was prejudiced against her by involuntary envy of her beauty, youth, and happiness, as well as by jealousy of her brother's love for her. Apart from this insuperable antipathy to her, Princess Mary was agitated just then, because on the Rostovs being announced, the old prince had shouted that he did not wish to see them, that Princess Mary might do so if she chose, but they were not to be admitted to him. She had decided to receive them, but feared lest the prince might at any moment indulge in some freak, as he seemed much upset by the Rostovs' visit. "There, my dear princess, I've brought you my songstress," said the count, bowing and looking round uneasily, as if afraid the old prince might appear. "I'm so glad you should get to know one another. Very sorry the prince is still ailing." And after a few more commonplace remarks, he rose. "If you'll allow me to leave my Natasha in your hands for a quarter of an hour, princess, I'll drive around to see Anna Semyonovna. It's quite near in the Dogs' Square, and then I'll come back for her." The count had devised this diplomatic ruse, as he afterwards told his daughter, to give the future sisters-in-law an opportunity to talk to one another freely. But another motive was to avoid the danger of encountering the old prince, of whom he was afraid. He did not mention this to his daughter, but Natasha noticed her father's nervousness and anxiety, and felt mortified by it. She blushed for him, grew still angrier at having blushed, and looked at the princess with a bold and defiant expression which said that she was not afraid of anybody. The princess told the count that she would be delighted, and only begged him to stay longer at Anna Semyonovna's, and he departed.